Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love live at the Wilbur Theater. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. And a very warm thank you to our musical guest, Height. Oh, here they go, they're off the stage, performing tonight's theme song, our theme song for Modern Love. We will hear more from her later in the show. But first, happy Valentine's Day. I want to make a note, you all chose to be here tonight on Valentine's Day. Now, whether you love Valentine's Day or dread it, or ignore it every year, I think we can basically all agree that love itself is truly worth celebrating, and that is what we're doing here tonight, right? That was very half-hearted. We are celebrating love, right? Much better. Okay, so full disclosure, I am a Valentine's Day ignorer. No, true. I never actually did like this holiday. Too manufactured. In my own life, I'm most often confronted by the fundamental irrationality of love, not so much through my husband. He is a patient and balanced human being. He's the balanced half of our relationship. But I am confronted by the irrationality of love by my children. So if their parents here, they're gonna know what I'm talking about. Because kids, I think, they're like these little stealth love torpedoes, right? They are powered by an inexhaustible id, busting through whatever defenses I thought I had with absolutely no respect for any of my rational adult concerns. Now, are there parents in the audience here? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So give me a couple minutes to tell you a quick story about my two-year-old. We go swimming every weekend, and last weekend we were in the locker room getting changed, and that's already a fraught and super judgy environment, as it is. And my son, right there in the locker room, just decides to have an epic tantrum. Full-blown two-year-old blowout. So he's there, just like there on the floor of the locker room screaming, "Mama!" Pauses, makes eye contact to be sure that I'm seeing this, and then again, "Mama!" at the top of his lungs for several minutes, right? Eventually drawing a small crowd of other small people dressed in like the cutest, you know, pink sharks, surfboards, swimming suits, right? Everyone's supposed to go to toddler swimming class here. And those little kids are whispering to their own mothers in that genuinely worried and concerned tone that 2 and 3 year olds have, right? Because they take everything literally and seriously. They're like tugging on their mom's arm saying, "What's wrong with that little baby?" Right? They're like, there's something wrong with him. Can we help him? Can we all be helpers here? Look for the helpers, right? So that little baby, my two-year-old, he's squatting on the floor. His face is red. There are just ginormous tears rolling down his eyes. His voice is getting raspy with rage, and he lets go one more, "Mama!" I hear this every day, by the way. You only get it 3 or 4 times tonight. So I'm like, okay, when they go low, we go high, right? I mean, I honestly feel like it's times like this we can all channel our inner Michelle a little bit. She's an example to us all. So I try patience. I try distraction. I'm like, hey, look, it's a hairdryer. I try singing a song. I pick him up. I try to give him reassurance. Reassurance that's like genuine at first. I'm like, you'll be fine. You'll be okay. You're all right. And then honestly, it becomes half-hearted reassurance. And then finally, just a flat-out lie, because all I really want my son to do at that moment is just shut up. And nothing worked. There's more yelling, lots and lots more. And finally, I kind of lose it. And I yell, oh my God, are you finished yet? And there are other mothers, of course, in the locker room. Judgy, environment and all. And my son, he stands up and he just stops freaking out and he says, yes. Okay, that was a little embellishment. To be honest, it was actually that sniffly, kind of sobbing, half sobbing, yes, that children do, the kind where you know that that will be fodder for future therapy, both for you and your child, in the many years to come. But I tell you this story because really it was just another one of those moments, daily moments, where I throw up my hands and I look at my children and I think, this makes no sense. How did that just happen? Why did that just happen? I mean, this 2-year-old, he is 100% id, right? He's all id. He's all unimpeded impulse, emotion, irrationality. He's resplendent with it. In fact, he's incandescent with it. So I think for me, actually, that's what love is. It's impulse that shoulders aside control. It's irrationality laughing in the face of logic. It's emotion taking the reins where intellect fears to drive. I mean, genuinely, I think about this a lot. How would we live without that? How would we even survive as a species? Because my love for my son makes me fundamentally irrational too. I give up sleep. Food, money, energy, time, and all sorts of other things for this child, and I do so willingly. I would defend him against any threat. I would lay down my life for him. I would travel to the ends of the earth for his safety and well-being, as, by the way, millions of parents are desperately trying to do even as we speak. So in the coldest, most dispassionate reading of what it means for an individual to survive, such behavior is not logical at all. And yet we give into it all the time. So why do we do this? One answer, I'm gonna talk about my kids, so I'm gonna talk about my parents for 1 second. Because one answer for me comes from my father. He is an intense Star Trek fan. This is a man who, when I was like 8 years old, legitimately told me, daughter, when I come back in my next life, it will be as a Vulcan. He was dead serious, too. A little Hinduism mixing with Star Trek lore. His favorite movie line of all time comes from Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Can I hear it for Star Trek III? No one... I know it's no Wrath of Khan, but it's an unheralded, it's an underappreciated classic. Anyway, this is the movie in which Spock's father, Sarek, says, there's a line, he says, he's speaking to some Vulcan elders, and he says, forgive me, Talar, my logic is uncertain where my son is concerned. Now, the first time I saw this movie, I was a totally tantrum-prone tween myself, and that line never really had any impact on me because I was like, yeah, blah, 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 let's get to the part where we, like, you know, are firing phasers again. But my later on, when my dad would often say, daughter, this is my favorite line in the movie, and he would say it to me, it suddenly became obvious. Saying that your logic is uncertain is the Vulcan dad way of saying, I love you. So there. That is my two cents on love. Take from it what you will. Just wanted to get you a little warmed up for the reason why we are actually all here tonight. Because this evening, you are going to hear three truly gorgeous meditations on love. Three modern love essays performed live, complete with beautiful soundscaping that you hear every week on the podcast. So, John Parati, one of the producers of the podcast, is going to be live mixing all the sound design tonight. Let's bring him out here. John's truly a master, and we are very lucky to have him. Our first piece, will be read by Alicia Reiner. Now, you know her as Natalie Figueroa, or Fig, from the hit Netflix series Orange is the New Black. We'll see if we can tease some hints from her about what season 5 has to hold. She also appeared in the FX series Better Things and ABC's How to Get Away with Murder, and she produced and starred in the film Equity. She's reading Laura Wilkinson Sinton's essay, The Magi at 40,000 Feet. Please welcome Alicia Reiner.
On Christmas morning, I stood waiting to board an 8 a.m. flight from Atlanta to San Diego with my 14 and 12-year-old sons. 2 years had passed since our move from Southern California to suburban Atlanta, and it had been a painful extraction, uprooting my boys from their schools and friends, all for the love of a man, John, who then remained entangled with his previous marriage and hesitant to forge ahead with me. My own first marriage had dissolved nearly a decade before when my boys were little, and in John, I knew I had found a shared future, yet it remained stubbornly beyond my grasp. So once again, I was traveling on Christmas Day, sparing us having to endure another Christmas morning that didn't jibe with the TV version. We were escaping to San Diego to find comfort among aunts and uncles and cousins in the familiar sun and sand. While waiting to board, I spied a beautiful young woman wrangling two small boys, toddlers who looked like they were in orbit around her, running and screaming and spinning. I guessed immediately she was also a single mother. With rare exception, women flying with small children by themselves on Christmas morning are single mothers. Sometimes life's circumstances are just too raw to pretend we're happily celebrating. Sometimes treating the day like an average weekday, as I was doing, is the path to take. So my boys and I had spent more than one Christmas morning on an airplane. After meeting John, though, I didn't think we'd be doing this again. There's something relentlessly compelling about the kind of love that causes you to change your life in ways that friends insist is insane and causes your family to wince and ask, "Are you sure this is a good idea?" John and I had agreed about having me and the boys move east so we all could be together and blend our families. But after we arrived, he balked. His divorce was still too fresh, the ex-wife boundaries not in place, and our engagement was broken off. Twice. He had only pretended to be ready so he wouldn't lose me, and I kept pretending to be patient while he worked it out. But after 2 years of waiting, I was readying myself to move back to San Diego. I was angry and disappointed. The holidays were supposed to be a family time, yet here we were, still not a family. I loved John, and he loved me, but love was not conquering our blended family obstacles or making him any more ready for what I needed. So I used up my flight miles and bolted with the boys for Christmas. I reread the second marriage divorce statistics to justify my decision. In the airport terminal, the other woman's boys looked to be about 2 and 3. For a 5-hour flight, that is a tall order. And even taller in this case, as the older boy was wearing a halo neck brace, evident of some recent trauma requiring his spine and head to be immobilized. His energy, however, was unimpaired. On the plane, as soon as my son settled in with their books and portable electronics, the woman and her boys found their seats 2 rows behind us in 16B and C, the younger on her lap and the older in the middle seat next to a man with a look of unmitigated dread. Both toddlers immediately started screaming. The one in the halo was loudly protesting the mandatory seatbelt aspect of airline travel. The other did not want to sit on his mother's lap. I knew that rodeo well. Only 5 more hours of screaming to go. When we hit cruising altitude, I exchanged a knowing glance with my boys, unbuckled my seatbelt, and went back 2 rows, and offered my seat to the ashen-faced man in 16A. He looked spectacularly relieved. I wished him a Merry Christmas and sat next to the woman and offered what every mother traveling alone with small one wants, an extra pair of hands. Over the next 3.5 hours, I read Dr. Seuss aloud. I walked up and down and up and down the single aisle of a 757, first with a 3-year-old in a bulky halo, then a 2-year-old. I amused them with hand puppets and changed diapers and doled out goldfish crackers and bottles and channeled every kind stranger who had done the same for me over dozens of flights I had taken alone with my kids. I glared down anyone who attempted to say anything unkind. God knows I had endured the jerks who would publicly pass judgment on child-rearing skills while I held a crying infant. For the record, no, I can't just keep this baby quiet on the airplane, and you can't either. 45 minutes from San Diego, one in her arms, one in mine, they both finally fell asleep. I looked up a few rows with my sons deep in their books and music and spoke of my own single parent challenges. I reassured her that it all turns out okay and that air travel does indeed get easier, a lot easier. She asked me about their father. He moved out of their life when they were not much bigger than your sons. I told her it was a slow heartbreak over time and a family history of addiction. They see him once a year for a week, which isn't enough. I thought they were going to have a new stepfather, but now I'm not sure I have the patience to wait any longer. I spoke to her about my struggle with John in Atlanta, about life's messy nature, and how I was uncertain I had made the right move, how I wanted him to hurry up and get to it, how angry I was that he couldn't seem to close the deal he opened by luring us to Atlanta. And now here it is, the holidays and our incomplete, awkward family situation. And your sons? Where's their father? I asked gingerly. She spoke softly. 6 months ago, my husband was killed in a car accident. I was at home with the baby, and my older son, she pointed to the 3-year-old with the halo, was airlifted in critical condition from the scene. He had a broken neck and severe internal injuries. It was touch and go for a while. He still has a way to go. I fly for Delta. I'm on leave, and I have to decide whether to keep the farm we live on in Florida or whether to get back to flying, and that's only the beginning of it. For now, I'm taking the boys to see my family in San Diego. She smiled wistfully. You never know how quickly life can change, she said. The life you plan... And her voice trailed off as she smiled at the sleeping boy in her lap. My troubles withered. I welled up, letting her know how sorry I was for the difficult hand she had been dealt. Of all the scenarios I had played out in my head for my life with or without John, that one wasn't on the whiteboard. John was trying to find a way to love me that wouldn't compromise his children, while I was trying to find a way to love him that wouldn't compromise mine. We had painfully wrestled over this to the point where I was just about through with the struggle, but it honestly never occurred to me that he could be gone in an instant. She and I both dozed for about 10 minutes, awakening to the pilot's voice announcing our final approach into Lindbergh Field, banking right on approach with the Coronado Bay Bridge sunlit on my left. We wished each other a Merry Christmas. I had intended to be the generous one that morning. My gift to her was an extra pair of hands to wrangle spirited toddlers trapped on a plane, but her gift to me was of the Magi order. It was the gift of perspective, of being able to step back and appreciate what I have, however frustrating. John loved me. I knew that. His worries about joining our family had complicated our love, not extinguished it. Struggles and patience are part of the deal. As soon as we hit the tarmac, I dialed John's number and told him I loved him. Thanks to that stranger on a plane, I discovered I had more patience and appreciation in me. And the next year, John and I married and finally spent Christmas morning together as a family, as we have ever since.
Alicia Reiner. Performing. Performing Laura Wilkinson Sinton's essay, The Magi at 40,000 Feet. Wow. Thank you so much for doing that. So don't go away just yet. You're actually an alum of Modern Love.
I am. I'm an avid reader of Modern Love, yeah. Too.
And you read one of the essays for us last year.
Laura Munson's, yeah.
What was it about Laura's essay that really grabbed
the
you?
This one. I mean, I first read it when I was a mom of a little one. I think my daughter was about 3 or 4, and I remember deeply sobbing. And I was actually worried, because in both cases, when I did the podcast, you guys sent me ones, and they happened to be some of my favorites. So when she sent it to me, I was so excited, but every time I read it at home trying to practice, I would start sobbing. And my biggest concern was that I wouldn't be able to get through it tonight, so I'm so glad I got through it. My sweet husband is in the audience, and he put tissues in my pocket.
It's true love, right? Well, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as I hinted before you came on stage, season 5 of Orange is the New Black. I know there's probably contractual obligations that we're dancing around here, but can you give us even the tiniest hint?
You might see Fig. And I think it's been out in the press now that it all takes place in 3 days. I think that has been announced by Danielle Brooks, not me first. So I can say that. So that's exciting. And I do. The one thing I really want to say about this story in this world today, now I will start to cry. This is a story about the kindness of strangers. And I think it is deeply, deeply important in our world today that we are kind to one another, that we take care of one another. And more than ever, kindness and love and being love as an activist, love as a verb to strangers, to the people you love, is so deeply, deeply important. And I feel so honored to be here tonight to talk about that, to express this beautiful piece of writing about that. So
thank you, Alicia, so, so much. Thank you. Alicia Reiner! Alicia, we look forward to losing a lot of sleep starting June 9th when season 5 of Orange is the New Black gets released on Netflix. Now, following the reading, the gorgeous reading of the essays, this is the point in the regular podcast where we get to hear from the author of the essay that we just heard, and we're going to do the same tonight. So it's been 5 years since Laura's piece came out in Modern Love, and she sent us this update, so let's listen.
John and I have been married for a number of years now. We've been together, hard to believe, for 20. And the struggles of the early days, you know, they're an echo in our relationship, but they're one of the things that make it so sweet now. The woman that I wrote about on the plane and her 2 sons, I think of her often. I carry her in my heart because she really helped me get to a place of gratitude. And I don't know where she is or where her life has gone. I hope it's gone to phenomenal places for her. She certainly had a rough go of it, but she also had that place of gratitude too. Any marriage or long-term relationship is difficult. But I think a lot of it is loving people for who they are. You know, John and I, we love each other for who we are. And to be really loved is one of the greatest human experiences we can have.
That's Laura Wilkinson-Sinton, author of The Magi at 40,000 Feet. She and John still live in Atlanta. Brian Tyree Henry of FX's Atlanta reads for us after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
It's time for a little music, everybody. Please welcome back Height.
Brak, ta, 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 brak, ta, dinner with my jacket on. It's raining and raining, the sky is falling down. No, don't you worry about my umbrella, I don't need it. I got a paper in my pocket and I'm waiting for the taxi to come. And I told the driver, go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. I'll give him a kiss and we'll be gone for good. I'll go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. Don't tell nobody. Oh, this is just between me and you. Driver, go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. I'll give him a kiss and we'll be gone for good. I'll go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. Don't tell nobody. Oh, this is just between me and hush your mouth, close your eyes. I got a big surprise. Careful. I got a big surprise. Careful words, perfect timing. Oh, I will go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. I'll give him a kiss and we'll be gone for good. Ooh, go straight away. I gotta meet my lover at the station. Don't tell nobody. Oh, this is just between
Go straight away. Thank you so much. We're going to hear from them again in just a few minutes. Our next performer stars as Alfred Miles, or Paperboy, in the FX series Atlanta. By the way, which just won the Golden Globe for Best TV Series, Music, or Comedy. Brian Tyree Henry is reading Matthew Parker's essay, A Student of Intimacy, Step by Step. Please welcome Brian Tyree Henry.
It is not true that women love outlaws. They may go for a guy with a few misdemeanors and a bad haircut, but that's about the extent of their interest in the proverbial bad boy. When it comes to real criminals with actual felonies and prison tattoos, many will settle for the nearest mechanic with dirty fingernails and a Japanese motorcycle. I have 8 felonies and at least twice that many misdemeanors. I've been to prison 5 times, all for nonviolent drug and drug-related offenses. I was basically a petty theft with a history of drug abuse, a past I'm neither proud of nor shy about admitting to. I am now a full-time student, and I've been clean for 8 years. But the deep blue tattoos on my arms are still plain to see. The profanity pouring from my mouth is plain to hear, and I smell like a tobacco factory. There's your outlaws, ladies. Read me and flee. So no one should be surprised that I seek love in an alien land. I met my girlfriend on a website that arranges relationships and marriages with women from Cali, No, not California, but Cali, Colombia. I recently returned from visiting her, my sixth trip in 2 years. I love Cali because it moves with a frantic purposefulness that would make army ants envious. The traffic lights there are more advisory than imperative. My girlfriend, Yedanith, is barely 5 feet tall. She's thin and beautiful with long, curly black hair and lightly freckled brown skin. She epitomizes the hustle of Cali, working full-time for a condominium complex. She also studies business administration and finance on weekends. I love it when I give her money to pay for a meal, say, and she shortchanges me. I pretend not to notice because it reflects a survival instinct that I am quite familiar with. Yedanith lives on about $60 a week. From this, she must pay her rent, tuition, and all the things that provide a modicum of comfort in a third world country. Every peso counts. 2 years ago, I bought the email addresses of 4 women on the Cali website for $10 each. I was 46, so I had been looking for women in their late 30s or early 40s. But Yedanith, who was 33, captivated me, especially her wide, friendly smile. She was also the first to write back, and after I sent her my photo, I received an email message from her every other day for months. Not a simple thing, considering she had to go to an internet cafe and pay to send them. I was thrilled. In prison, nothing is more depressing than an empty mailbox. For inmates, letters sent via snail mail are a touch of love in a place where its deprivation is part of the punishment. They're also status symbols with bragging rights. It was devastating when letters from women who supposedly loved me were few and far between. Within 2 months, I started calling Yedanith once a week. She spoke no English and my Spanish was mediocre, so conversation was difficult, but also fun. Bantering between giggles to try to make ourselves understood. After 3 months, I arranged a trip to Colombia and booked a room at the Radisson, just a mile or so from her apartment. Our first meeting was in the hotel lobby. Dressed simply in a mini skirt and high heels, she was even more beautiful than in her pictures. We ate dinner in the hotel restaurant, then took a taxi to an outdoor cafe to sip Colombian beer and talk. I kissed her in the cab on the way home. The ride was too quick for me, a mere half mile from the Radisson. After a final kiss in front of the hotel, I watched the taxi drive her away into the alien streets of Cali. Yedanith had to maintain her usual work and school schedule during my visit, so our time together was limited to 4 hours a night. She would not, however, spend the night with me, and my attempts to lure her up to my room ended in failure. This upset me, but overall, I was happy just to have her there as we wandered the malls or sat in a theater, her hand resting comfortably in mine until kiss by kiss, she began to fill the void inside me. When I got out of prison in 2002, I was narcotics free for the first time since I was a teenager, and achingly lonely. Yet I had never had a normal relationship, and I was clueless about how to get myself into one. My 11 years of forced celibacy in prison and decades of drug use had left me inept when it came to women. I experimented with various forms of dating, including online, but most of the women I managed to meet could not come to terms with my past. Inmates typically suffer from what I call touch deprivation. It's not so much the absence of sex that's so distressing, but the absence of physical intimacy. Yedanith filled this emptiness in me even as she treated my entire first trip to Cali as a first date. She quickly laid out the rules. Intimate touching was allowed, sex was not. "We're not ready," she'd say, again and again, and so I battened myself down, determined to make this relationship work. My second visit 4 months later was viewed by her as a second date. Although she would now accompany me to my room, sex was still not an option. I was angry and showed it, but Yedanith was as lovable as ever. On my last night there, while we watched a movie in my room, I coaxed while she gently but firmly said no. I glowered. "I know you have women in New York," she said to me in Spanish. "Many women. Men always have women." Yedanith had put her profile on the website because she had given up on Latin men. The idea of mistresses, almost obligatory for the Colombian male, mocks her belief in traditional marriage. You cannot have love without trust, she believes, and trusting men does not come easily. She was at least more hopeful about American men. You have girlfriends, no? She repeated. No. Mentiroso, she replied with a laugh. Liar. I turned back to the TV. The movie was in English with Spanish subtitles, although I barely noticed. What am I doing here? I thought. Before I met Yerenith, I had come across many internet scams. Most of the women I corresponded with in foreign countries simply wanted money. One in Russia told me her family's horse had died and she needed $400 to buy a new one, while others were ready to marry me sight unseen. Both types became easy to spot because they would tell me they loved me within a month. Yerenith had yet to utter to me the Spanish phrase, te quiero. After 10 months of email messages, phone calls, and visits, I longed for her to say it, though I valued her restraint. She didn't seem to have an ulterior motive. Aside from her little hustle of shortchanging me on occasion, she never asked me for a dime. Sure, she could be seeking United States citizenship, but even if that was her secret goal, which I doubted, I had my own secrets. I hadn't yet told her about my past. If I expected trust in return, then she deserved to know. She was surprised by the story of the last 20 years of my life, but listened quietly. Although barely batting an eye over my years in prison, she was angry about my past drug use. In her eyes, it is the American lust for narcotics that gives Colombia such a bad name. She was also concerned that I would relapse. I explained that my commitment to education was how I stayed clean. I had earned my BA in English literature just 2 months earlier and would be moving on to graduate school in the fall. I told her about the memoir I was writing that chronicled my years as an addict, that not only was it a form of redemption for me, but might help others. This was a crucial first step in establishing trust between us. On my third trip, 6 months later, we met in the resort town of Cartagena. I was sick with the nasty virus and spent a lot of time in bed. Unconcerned about catching it, she barely left my side. And it was there, on the romantic beaches of the Caribbean, that we exchanged vows of both love and loyalty. It would be nice to bring her to New York around Christmas, her favorite time of year. She loves the lights that decorate Cali for Navidad. How exciting would it be for her to see Rockefeller Center lightened up or Times Square? Unfortunately, it seems the only way I can get her in the country is through marriage. But when I offered to marry her to bypass all this bureaucracy, she was furious. Marriage is much more than a legal document, she said in her fast-flowing Spanish. It is a joining of our hearts. And how would I finish my education? Nothing is more important than our education. I couldn't argue with that because I feel the same way. It would be hard to have her with me now anyway. Financially, it would be impossible. And the prospect of moving here, frankly, intimidates her. I was encouraged, however, by her use of the word our. Paciencia, Mateo, she counsels me when I express my frustration. Paciencia. Yes, I'll be patient. I'll wait as long as it takes. Patience is a virtue that, for better or worse, I am all too familiar with.
Brian Tyree Henry. Knocking it out of the park, I should say, with Matthew Parker's essay, A Student of Intimacy, Step by Step. Brian, first of all, congratulations on that Golden Globe.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
One of the questions that the Modern Love staff most often receives is about how the casting process works. And Alicia said a little bit earlier that sometimes we send a bunch of essays to folks, and then they get to choose whichever one they want. So what was it about this one that made it seem like the one for you?
I think what is so special about this one is the concept of this long-distance love that still endured the times. How love knows no race, color, gender, any landscape. It's the most beautiful thing. Love is so not tangible. It's not something we can feel and touch. It's something that just is. And between the two of them, even the language barrier or the distance, it still didn't matter because she meant everything to him. And I think that that is so important in this life, in this world. And I think that it's a blessing when you find a love like that. That just it doesn't matter how far you are, what time zone, what, it's just the love that matters. So that one really stuck out to me.
Beautifully said. Thank you again, Brian Tyree Henry. That essay also really strikes me as a exemplary of perseverance and grit. So we have a postscript now from Matthew Parker, the author of the piece we just heard Brian read. Matthew's essay was actually published in the New York Times 8 years ago, and he and Yedinith have now been together for 10 years. But get this, I mean, Yedinith is still in Colombia. And Matt lives in Scottsdale, Arizona, but he does go down to visit her a couple of times a year, so he sent us this update.
The relationship is on solid footing. I mean, we love each other very much. The only problem is the long distance thing, but we've grown accustomed to it. So there's a level of trust between us that is hard to find in most relationships. The great thing about it is she has total faith in me. She calls me un gran escritor, which means you are a great writer, she tells me all the time. And so her faith in me gives me more faith in myself than I might normally have. There's no real translation for when my ship comes in. So the way we translate it is, my ship is close. Mi lancha es cerca. My ship is getting close. And that's kind of what we live on.
Matthew Parker, author of A Student of Intimacy, Step by Step. Matthew's taken big steps in other areas of his life as well. He got his master's from Columbia University in 2012. He wrote a graphic memoir called Larceny in My Blood. And he's currently finishing a novel. He teaches creative writing at three different schools, but he's hoping to land a full-time teaching position and finally bring Yedinith to the United States. Brian Tyree Henry read us Matthew Parker's essay. This week, he will guest star on the NBC series This Is Us. You can catch it Tuesday night or online at NBC.com. More from the show in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Next week on the podcast, part two of our live show featuring Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, and Emmy Rossum, star of the Showtime hit show, Shameless. Here's a little taste of what's waiting for you.
Unfollow him, my friends would roar. You're never going to get over him unless you unfollow him on all that stuff. But I couldn't. There was just something so enthralling about being able to track his social life. Was he seeing someone else? I had to know. Besides, unfollowing him was too dramatic, as if I were proclaiming, I can't handle this. Remaining friends on social media, however, showed that I was unfazed. I was cool, chill, and whatever. But I wasn't any of those things. I'd find myself scrolling through his tweets and Instagram posts, which included photos of other women. I'd shove my phone into my friends' faces, their noses practically fogging the screen, and I'd ask, is she prettier than me? One night, drunk, at 2 a.m., I was trying to decipher if an innocuous Drake lyric he had tweeted could somehow be directed at me as a possible admission of affection.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Special thanks to Taylor Blumenreich, Matt Baxter, and Kyle McHugh at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.